The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this oral argument, April 21st. We have one case on our oral calendar today. That's Kamal v. Is it Arkpal Kamal? I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. But Kamal v. Kamal. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Although we are appearing by Zoom and we can see each other just fine with our names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceeding today. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of it on the public audio recording. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. If we have any glitches, by the way, if you have difficulty hearing any of the judges or opposing counsel or seeing anyone, just bring it to our attention and we'll try to get the technological issues sorted out. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Miller and I am here on behalf of Clerk Donald Camel. And the first issue that I would like to address is the issue with respect to whether the district court erred when it adopted verbatim the contradictory proposed findings from both of the parties with no indication that it had any independent review of the evidence or any independent determinations regarding credibility. And the reason I want to start with, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do I understand that that is a standalone argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's a standalone
argument. I'm sorry. Do you believe it's a standalone argument that it, the basis for reversal by itself, or that it needs it just attaches to one of the other arguments?
I believe it's both. It is a standalone argument in that it's the court said in Bliss that it's not reversible error per se to adopt a party's proposed findings verbatim. I've not found a case like this case in which they were adopted verbatim, but from both parties, so they were contradictory, and there's absolutely no evidence that the or indication that the court actually examined evidence or judged credibility witness, etc. And that's only with respect to these accounting issues. I believe in other parts of the order, in contrast, it's clear that the court did examine evidence and weigh evidence and determine credibility. And so in this small section, yes, the answer to your question is, I believe that it is reversible error on its own. However, if the court were not to reverse on that ground, there's a heightened standard with respect to the other accounting issues. Because while generally the court would give deference to a trial court's findings of fact, the deference is there because the trial court's in a better position to judge testimony. It has the witnesses right there in front of it. It's examining evidence as it comes in, and it's just better able to make these determinations.
Did you bring this to the district court's attention in post-trial motions, and did the district court fully resolve those problems?
Both parties made motions for amended findings. Our motions for amended findings did directly address this issue. And that was our argument, basically. The motions for amended findings were complicated because Judge Sullivan presided over the three-day trial. And then we made our motions, and then she rotated off the bench. So then referee Ogilvie decided the motions. And so he did not have, you know, obviously had not been present for the trial. He did not have the trial transcript because the testimony had not yet been transcribed. There's no evidence that he looked at any of the exhibits. And essentially what he did is sort of rubber stamp what the district court did, you know, for which he really can't be blamed. He can't, you know, there's no way for him to listen to testimony.
So the conflicting findings about which you're complaining, they persisted even in the final amended order.
Correct, Your Honor, except for some of the mathematical errors were corrected and some of the contradictions were. However, some of the contradictions were reconciled by merely adopting respondents' proposed amended findings, which sought to reconcile these contradictions in her favor, while appellant's proposed amended findings are more addressed to the fact that the findings with respect to these two issues, the allocation of mortgage expenses and the one-time claimed expenses, that there was just no findings in the record for it. And so the reconciliation is not based upon any review of the record and any review of transcripts or exhibits. It again was just blindly adopted from proposed findings.
In your brief, in part one of your brief, you do not make a specific request for a particular remedy. I mean, what is your requested remedy? What should we do about this alleged error?
For this alleged error, I believe it should be findings regarding the allocation of the mortgage expense and the one-time expenses should be reversed. And even if it were not reversed on this basis, because these findings were adopted verbatim on just that basis alone, there's a heightened standard that this court should follow according to the Supreme Court. And that is that it should heed how the findings were made. And then it should subject the record to a careful and searching review.
Well, the Supreme Court says that in the context of wholesale adoption of one party's findings of fact. And I appreciate your argument that the district court accepted some of the findings of the respondent, but it's not wholesale. I mean, there were chunks, and this happens in these cases routinely. I'm not convinced that the heightened review standard applies in a case like this, where you have adoption of findings by both parties. You have a chance to challenge that on post-trial motions, and the district court does, in fact, make amended findings. Can you point us to a case that's similar to this one in that regard?
Your Honor, I can't, because this is more egregious than simply choosing one side's proposed findings. Here, you're right. Usually, if the court goes through and chooses one side's for this issue and the other side's for another issue, it shows that it made some determination and picked and chose. Here, everything in the findings of fact and the accountings, all of it came from the proposed findings of fact. Any reference in those findings of fact with reference to credibility determinations can be directly traced back to proposed findings. There is not one, there is maybe two paragraphs where the court adds up numbers. Otherwise, the entire section is taken verbatim from either respondent's proposed findings or appellant's proposed findings. And that's why it's so repetitive. At one point, it says doesn't say according to appellant's proposed findings, but it does adopt appellant's proposed finding. And it says for this property, this was the income, this was the expense, we have to add in some depreciation, and the total amount owed is X. And then there's another paragraph that addresses something that is from respondents' proposed findings. And then with respect to proposed findings, what I mean is that addressed like 113 Warwick, which is completely irrelevant. But those findings were also taken wholesale from respondents' proposed findings. Every proposed findings in the whole accounting issue came from one of the parties. And I believe this is set forth in appellate's brief, in which it's shown that every single paragraph can be traced back. And so once there's the accounting, it says, here's the income expenses, and here's this calculation with respect to one property. And then it says, with respect to the same property, here's the analysis, income expenses, here's the analysis with respect to the same property, but with a different outcome. And so there's two different outcomes with respect to each property in the initial findings. And so then what the court did is it just decided it just split it down the middle. And so essentially what it did is just average the accountings. It didn't say it was doing that, but that was the net result, because it did adopt wholesale these findings. There's no, in the findings with respect to the custody and parenting time issues, You can see that the court did consider evidence. It adopted some of the findings from respondent regarding domestic abuse issues, adopted some of the findings from appellant with respect to parental alienation, but it also put in its own findings with respect to domestic abuse. It made its own independent finding and used its own language to say that it found that those incidences were too remote, had happened too far in the past, and therefore had no bearing on the custody and parenting time issues. You will not see that at all in the accounting issues. Every single finding of fact can be traced directly back to, not every single, because the court did, after it did the analysis that both parties have proposed, there are paragraphs where it does add things up and then split it up. But all of those findings are directly from the party's proposed findings. So it might be, it's misleading, I believe, to say that when the court just, you know, chooses from these findings, from respondent, chooses from these findings from appellant. I understand that that shows that it's making a determination, but that's just not what occurred here.
I'll just remind you, you have only 5 minutes remaining for the substance of your argument. Oh,
thank you, Your Honor. So if you then, because even if it was just adopted verbatim from one party, which I submit would be much less egregious than just wholesaling, taking it from both parties so that it's all contradictory. The Supreme Court has said that when that is done, you have to take heed the ways that the findings were made and do a careful and searching review of the record. And that sounds like maybe a daunting task with this fairly large record. However, the accounting issues in the order are very small, and there's very little evidence to support the mortgage allocation and the one-time expenses.
Let me ask Ms. Miller. I mean, you say there's very little evidence, and I think you're probably referring to the lack of receipts or, you know, third-party documentation and so on. Respondent did, you know, she wrote up what might be called summary exhibits, which were fairly detailed. And it seems like in general, her testimony, you know, sort of in support of those calculations was fairly extensive, more so than your client's evidence. I guess it seems like at a glance, the evidence in the record, it seems like respondent put in more evidence into the record than petitioner did or than appellant did about these accounting issues. Do you disagree with me?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But the reason that respondent or that appellate would put in less evidence is because he did not have access to any of the books or records for the 2 years prior to the trial. Respondent has the burden of proof on these issues. So she has the burden to come forward and show the receipts. The testimony that she gave with respect to the mortgage allocation issue, which involves at least three transactions, and her claims of her one-time expenses, which is $31,000 in claimed expenses, for which not one receipt was offered. And even the estimates that she offered don't match up with the amount that she says that she paid.
Doesn't the case law say that, you know, documentation is not necessarily required, that if a district court finds a party's testimony to be credible and relies on that testimony, that, you know, the Court of Appeals is not going to reverse those findings for lack of underlying documentation or receipts?
That's correct, Your Honor, but that is just as you just said. If the district court had examined the evidence and the testimony and made that finding, that could be correct. However, no court has ever reviewed the testimony or the exhibits to determine if that's true. No court has ever examined this testimony. There's 15 pages of trial transcripts and 4 small exhibits that support this whole allocation theory and all of these transactions that supposedly took place. And this $31,000 worth of claimed expenses. And the transaction she's testifying about took place 11 years ago. She was able to come up with some stray document from 2000 and one document from 2011. Let me think of my time here. But yet she could not come up with some receipts on which she based these numbers. It's not humanly possible for her to be able to testify about these numbers that on things that took place 10 years ago.
Am I correct, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but just in the interest of time, am I correct that the bottom line for all of these accounting issues, as you've called them, Was that petitioner owes respondent $14,000 in change? I'm looking at it. I'm looking at addendum page 117. I think that's the end of the court's narrative discussion in the amended order. And I guess my question is, what do you think that number should be? Your appellate brief does not give us an alternative exactly about, you know, how that finding should have, what the resulting number should have been.
Well, because the two issues, the $31,000 should not be considered. So that would make that number $15,000 less. The mortgage allocation.
Okay, $31,000, and what are you referring to?
That's the total of the one-time claimed expenses for which there's no documentation or credible evidence, the credible testimony. And then approximately, I believe it's $10,000 or so was allocated from the property for which she was responsible for paying the mortgage expenses, and was just allocated out to these other properties for which my client had to pay half, according to this theory that has never been explained and has many defects in it, as explained in my appellate's brief. And I see I'm running out of time.
Well, so let me just, I mean, I have some questions as well about the governing law here, and I might ask respondents counsel some questions, but I think the logic, am I correct, is that the refinancing of the Warwick property in 2011 was not solely, I mean, the party's purpose was to finance or refinance actually three different properties, to pay off an existing loan secured by the Morrison County property, and I think to pay off an existing loan or to assist with refinancing the St. Clair property as well as the Warwick property. And so that even though the parties, you know, chose to do one refi instead of three, the respondent's position is that the mortgage payments on the refinance loan should be allocated that way. And it seems like your client at trial did not dispute that logic. Am I correct about that? I mean, in other words, it'd be one thing if you and your client, I can't remember if you were trial counsel or not, but it'd be one thing if your clients had disputed that entire rationale or that logic, but it seems like at trial, your client sort of accepted that basic premise and then was arguing about the details. But please correct me if you think I'm wrong.
Your Honor, he testified that there was no mortgage on Morrison, that property has never been proved to have had a mortgage on it at the time of the refinance. He did not make legal arguments during trial. He did dispute some of the numbers, and these properties that were being refinanced. For example, the refinance of one-third of the Warwick property, she is attempting to just allocate half of the mortgage expenses, the mortgage expenses for which she's 100% responsible, out to the other properties. Does not explain why the mortgage expense would be not be allocated from the entire property. And this for the closing costs of St. Clair, that's not anything that would be wrapped up into a mortgage. That's a one-time expense, closing costs you pay and you're done. There's never been, if you look at the very few documents that are available here, there's the settlement statement. And before that, there is an affinity document. First of all, the settlement statement was not ever mentioned anytime except in respondents' responsive brief. But if you look at those documents, the numbers don't match up. In 2000, a loan was taken out for $77,000 was the part that would have gone to the purchase of the land. 11 years later, that would have been paid down to about $40,000. She claims that she used $88,000 from the 2011 Warwick refinance to pay off that loan. The initial amount that was borrowed 11 years earlier was $77,000. There's no way that it could be $88,000 a decade later. I mean, there's so many problems with this argument. There's no legal theory for this. The only time that it was allocated was, it wasn't allocated this way during the marriage. She said that if the properties were sold or awarded to a party, then she didn't believe that there should be any sort of, that the property should owe anything to the Warwick property.
One more question.
This allocation, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm mindful of the normal time limit. So this argument that you're making right now, is it based on evidence in the record, either from your cross-examination of respondent or from your presentation of evidence through your own client?
It is available by looking at the settlement statement and the affinity loan document. By looking at those documents, you can see that it does not match up, and those are the.
But did he testify to any of the factual statements that you just mentioned?
About the numbers not matching up, I don't believe so. He was testifying about factual issues, not making arguments or attempting to educate the court on how the math wasn't adding up. At the time, those documents were not even, they're not even part of the trial record. So there was nothing to be used to cross-examine respondent because they were not in the record. They were not part of the trial exhibits. They were pulled out when respondent wrote her respondents or responsive brief. Otherwise they were not part of the record.
Thank you, Ms.
Yeah.
I believe we've
thank you.
A bit over, but you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, I'm going to add 5 minutes to your clock. We usually don't go over quite as much, but just in the interest of parity, we'll give you, we don't have any other oral arguments this morning, and there's a bit to unpack here, and we've gone over for appellant's counsel, so we'll try to balance things out. Whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I am Ruta Johnson, and I represent the respondent, Shannon Scarpole Camel, in this appeal. Essentially, we're here today for a third bite at the apple. We're still arguing about facts. We're arguing about finances. We're arguing about expenses. We're arguing about circumstances of the 2011 refinance, et cetera. Appellant did not get what he wanted at the trial. He did not get what he wanted at the motion for amended findings hearing, and he did not get what he wanted at the post-trial motion hearings. Deciding factual disputes is not the role of this court. This court is an error-correcting court, and the trial court appropriately exercised its discretion and corrected errors at the motion for amended findings stage based on review of the record and the evidence contained therein. While it's true that based on this record, the parties' positions during the various stages of these proceedings, the court could have issued a different order, a different outcome was possible, but that's not the standard to be applied here today. Appellant brings a number of issues for this court's review, and the underlying theme with most of these issues brought by appellant is whether the record supports the findings made by the court. And the record does support the findings made by the court. The trial court, in terms of this allegation that there has not been a court that has reviewed the record, that's just simply inaccurate. The initial trial court, Judge Sullivan, sat through 3 days of trial and had the benefit of listening to witness testimony and judging witness credibility, had the benefit of reviewing the exhibits that were supplied by respondent as well as by the appellant, and assign appropriate weight to that evidence. The subsequent court had the access to recordings of the trial, had the same access to the record and the same exhibits, and did review them in assessing and analyzing the various motions and requests at the motion for amended findings stage. And so now two courts have reviewed the evidence and have issued the orders that it did. And so again, like I said earlier, we're here for this third bite at the apple.
Ms. Johnson, so the underlying documentation or receipts that might have been introduced but weren't, were they disclosed in discovery? I mean, in other words, is there more discovery beneath the surface here, documents exchanged to support these items, which would have allowed appellant to cross-examine your client about some of those numbers?
Yes, Your Honor. I was not trial counsel, but based on my review of the record and all the case files accessible to me, I understand that every piece of information that was available was disclosed to appellant's counsel and was available for cross-examination, was available for making any arguments either at trial, in pretrial briefs, in post-trial submissions in terms of proposed findings at the stages of motion for amended findings. All of the calculations were shared. There was a lot of information that was available and accessible to the appellant.
My next question, if I may, is that, so these on what's been referred to as accounting issues, I'm curious about the governing law, the applicable law. You in your brief have cited the law concerning division of property. Feels like we're dividing expenses, not dividing property. What is the legal basis for share, you know, for reallocating or reimbursing each other for these expenses?
Your Honor, I would argue that these are not necessarily expenses, but rather liabilities that were incurred by respondent and respondent that sought appellant's share in these liabilities. And that would be the reason why we cited the Division of Marital Property statute in support of this issue.
Liabilities to each other, not to third parties.
Correct.
It doesn't seem like the type of, so did, was the district court bound, before trial there was a stipulation concerning who has access to which properties, and also that stipulation had a paragraph concerning expenses. You're probably familiar with it. Both parties hereto are mutually enjoined and restrained from obtaining credit or making charges of goods and services with three exceptions. Does that paragraph govern the district court's resolution of these so-called accounting issues?
I think to a certain extent it does. I think the key point here is that respondent was tasked with maintaining these properties during the pendency of the proceeding. And as part of this task, she had to maintain the marital property and ensure that it will be in good standing, it will be available for the parties to be divided. And so her incurring of these expenses, as was found by trial court and again by subsequent court at the motion for amended finding stages, these expenses were necessary to maintain the party's marital estate. And so I don't believe that it is inconsistent with—
That's one of the exceptions, right? I mean, necessary for the generation of income or preservation of assets. I'm paraphrasing a little bit.
Correct.
So is that the legal basis for the district court to award these payments back and forth?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. So with respect to the boiler in the Warwick property, I assume, is there one boiler for both units? And did your client seek reimbursement for the full cost of the boiler replacement?
Your Honor, whether there is the boiler is for both units, I am not certain. She did not seek reimbursement for the whole cost. She sought reimbursement for a percentage of it. She requested one half of the cost.
Okay, how do we know that?
I believe it's contained in the record, and she testified to it, as well as it was part of the arguments made in proposed findings submitted by respondents' trial counsel.
Another question having to do with the one-time expenses, which relate to Warwick and other properties. I think that they are described in the document marked Exhibit 140, but my understanding is that document was not admitted into evidence as an exhibit. Is there other evidence other than 140 that supports the findings concerning the one-time expenses of Warwick? And maybe that document is limited to the Warwick property. Is there other evidence in the record that supports all of those numbers?
There is, Your Honor. There are a number of exhibits that supported the one-time expenses. Those exhibits are Exhibit 11, Exhibit 12, Exhibit 141, Exhibit 142, Exhibit 143, 144, and 145. In addition, she also testified quite extensively about these expenses. For example, if the court would review the trial transcript on page 508, she testified about the water heater. On page 508, again, she testified about the fact that the property was not up to code. On 510, you can find testimony about the refrigerator issues. 514 contains testimony about plumbing issues and the support beam. 515, there are issues about tree removal that she testified to. 518, fire inspection. Those are just a few examples of the extensive testimony and evidence that she submitted to support her assertion that she should be compensated for a share of these one-time expenses. And I would also point out to this court that these expenses, so appellant challenged the sharing of these expenses to a certain extent at the trial stage, and again at the motion for amended finding stages. Now, these arguments may have not been extensive, but the subsequent court, the referee who reviewed the initial trial court's record and issued the motion for amended findings decision, specifically noted that, yes, appellant did object to these one-time expenses, but one party's disagreement with the evidentiary weight assigned is not a valid basis to amend findings. And this is contained in appellant's addendum, page 69, finding 13. So again, we're revisiting this issue of, well, do we have these factual disputes? Should she have incurred these expenses? This has been decided. The evidence has been submitted. Two courts reviewed the weight of the evidence, assigned appropriate credibility to both parties, the evidence, their testimony, and issued an order that unfortunately for appellant is not what he wanted. But just because a different or an alternative ruling was available, just because some evidence may support a different outcome, that is not the standard that this court applies. And with regards to this one-time expense issue or even the mortgage reallocation issue, the court didn't abuse its discretion. And I apologize, I don't recall which one of your honors pointed this out. Some of the arguments that appellant brings forward today did not appear at the trial stages and did not appear at the motion for amended finding stages. So appellant argued today about this different math. This math was included in appellant's reply brief, not even in the initial brief submitted for this court's review. These are new arguments. Neither the trial court nor the subsequent court reviewing the trial court's order had the opportunity to address any of these arguments, and it would not be appropriate to act on them today.
Ms. Johnson, can I bring you back to the kind of the questions we were asking Ms. Miller at the beginning? Isn't part of the problem, that's what she's highlighting, is it's difficult for us to determine how a judge exercises discretion when a wholesale acceptance of one party's contradictory findings are received and become part of the order? And I see in your brief, you just summarily say the judge made the district court made its own separate findings, but I have to admit it's a bit hard to discern a huge distinction on the critical issues that we've been talking about today that were independently reviewed by the district court. How, in your opinion, would we be able to conclude that, in fact, the judge independently exercised discretion despite the acceptance of your client's proposed findings so significantly?
Certainly, Your Honor. we did talk a little bit, or appellant's counsel and your honors talked a little bit about Bliss. And I would bring the court's attention back to Bliss in that even if the court would have adopted one party's proposed findings wholesale, that's not reversible error per se. I believe based on the record that has been submitted for your honors to review, you can still conduct an independent, meaningful review of the trial court's order. The key point here is that the trial court undoubtedly made a little bit of a mess of the initial order. There's some contradictory findings. There is some adoption of appellant's proposed findings, some adoption of respondent's proposed findings, but also some independent analysis. And that's important. Now, this issue came up at the motion for amended finding stage, and the subsequent court was able to review the underlying order, review the evidence provided, and correct the errors that the initial court made. And so it's these orders in conjunction or together, if this court reviews those orders together with the underlying evidence, that gets you there to that meaningful review, to the ability to affirm the trial court's decision.
Ms. Johnson, I have a question about the award of conduct-based fees because appellant did not attend the FENE. How did his absence contribute to the, I'm forgetting the language of the statute right now, the delay or additional expenses of the proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. So when the court awarded respondent conduct-based fees based on appellant's absence at this FEME, part of what the court reviewed was underlying submissions in respondent's trial attorney's affidavit for attorney fees, and that was submitted as part of the record as document 62. There was a pattern of behavior by appellant insisting on participation in alternative dispute resolution processes, such as the financial early neutral evaluation, and then failing to appear. This happened on more than one occasion, and in fact, he also failed to appear at the moderated settlement conference that happened later. With regards to your specific question and how that increased the length and expense of the proceeding, In order for the parties to be able to engage in a meaningful financial early neutral evaluation where the neutral is able to provide evaluative feedback, where the parties are able to discuss agreements and reach agreements, that was not possible. Now,
But Mr. Black's letter, I don't think, doesn't say that. It doesn't say that we were unable to accomplish anything because of his absence. It seems like the parties met for several hours. It was not rescheduled in order to, you know, there was no duplication of time, it appears. It appears like your attorney, your client's attorney spent the same amount of time attending to the FENE than your attorney would have if he had attended. I don't see the difference in the expenses to your client.
The difference, Your Honor, is that the parties were not able to get evaluative feedback or reach substantive agreements that could have reduced the trial issues, limited the trial issues, and the need for a three-day trial to a smaller, maybe, time frame. The parties made the best out of a really unfortunate situation based on appellant's lack of participation. Mr. Black's letter, what I think we have to be really cautious in is there is a presentation of some productive discussions that were had. The parties were not able to reach any agreements. What they were able to do is do like a pseudo discovery conference where they reviewed a balance sheet to see whether there are areas where both of them are on the same page. Now, Ms. Miller was not able to reach agreements on appellant's behalf. That would have been unethical. He was not reachable, which is something that was documented in Mr. Black's letter. So they made the best out of it. They weren't able to accomplish what the purpose of the financial early neutral evaluation was. There was some duplication of what happened there because both parties' trial counsel prior to this financial early neutral evaluation had already discussed some of the documents that needed to be exchanged. Was this a productive use of time? Yes. Did it still contribute to unnecessary length and expense of the proceedings? It did, because the purpose of the financial early neutral evaluation is to receive the evaluative feedback and see if agreements can be reached. And without the appellant there, that was not possible. Mr. Black was not able to provide evaluative feedback. And when you look at it as a pattern of appellant's behavior, even though the court only made findings about the financial early neutral evaluation, based on the review of Doc 62, which contains that attorney fees affidavits, your honors would see that this was a much larger issue that over time contributed to the length and expense of the proceedings.
I have one more question about the appellant's post-trial motion for attorney's fees. In your view, was that motion properly and timely brought in that way rather than being requested as at trial or inserted as one of the trial issues? I believe that your client requested attorney fees at trial or as part of the issues to be determined at trial. Appellant did not. Appellant did that in a post-trial motion. Is that proper?
Your Honor, it's proper to the extent that the attorney fees solely requested fees for the post-trial motions and issues contained therein in terms of timeliness. And it is not proper to the extent that it requested fees for trial-specific issues. Now, the court denied those requests, and I know part of Appellant's argument was that we don't really know why, because there were no findings made, but I would submit to your honors that the court at the post-trial motions took the very similar approach to denying both parties' respective attorney fees requests for having to bring the motions for amended finding and seeking enforcement of certain provisions that were being amended. And therefore, the denial was proper, and this court is able to conduct an appropriate review based on the evidence that's already in the record.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, this is the major misconception about this entire case. This is not the third bite of the apple.
Just for the record, if you could just restate your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Kathleen Miller on behalf of the appellant, Clark Donald Camel.
Thank you.
This is not the third bite of the apple. There have been no bites of the apple. I just urge the court to read the brief where I trace back where every single finding can be found in the proposed orders. Any statement where it says, well, the court finds that the evidence is more credible that these expenses should be adopted. The language is directly from respondents' proposed findings. Contradictory.
What is your belief as to the reason why the rules and district courts encourage proposed findings?
I think they encourage proposed findings because courts are busy and there are the proposed findings encapsulate the issues and what they would want the court to find and what they believe the evidence supports.
I'm trying to distinguish between a challenge to adopting language verbatim and adopting wholesale findings of fact. It seems to me those are different things, and I'm not sure that the distinction is clear to me in your argument.
The distinction is this. We each had an accounting. We each had, we said, this is how the numbers are, and this is how these numbers should be construed. And so the court didn't decide. I think respondents' numbers are better. I think her accounting is more legitimate. Never made that decision. Instead, just chose appellants and then chose respondents. So there was never any indication that it actually reviewed the numbers. Frankly, these findings are 9.7% of the entire findings. There were very complicated custody and parenting time issues. I believe that the court spent its time there. It certainly did not spend its time on these accounting issues. As respondent admits, it was a mess. It's all contradictory. there it says two different people are responsible for a fee. It's a big mess. There was no thought given to it. It should have said for this property, here's the income, here's the expenses. I think this is reasonable. I think these other things are not reasonable. But no one ever indicated that they looked at any of them. One of the expenses claimed for the St. Clair property is before the valuation date. Any court looked at that would say, well, this isn't part of this accounting, which is addressing the post-valuation date to trial date. Instead, it's just included in there. Now, these accountings, saying that when respondent says that the number of exhibits to support these accountings, the only two exhibits that are not illustrative exhibits are exhibits 142 and 144, and neither one of them provides support. These illustrative exhibits are, you sit down at the kitchen table and you write up your numbers, apparently, because respondent's first accounting differed from her second accounting, not only in time span, but in adding a whole new mortgage allocation theory that she had not.
Ms. Miller, my understanding is 140 was illustrative, not admitted, but 141 through 145 were admitted. Am I wrong about that?
143, I believe, was not admitted. They were admitted for illustrative purposes. As the court states, these are illustrative exhibits.
So what you're saying, 140 and 143 were illustrative and not admitted as substantive evidence, just those
I'm
two?
I'm saying that all of them except 142 and 144 were submitted as illustrative. All of the accountings were admitted as illustrative exhibits, except for there were two that supposedly contained supporting documents, which they do not. The entire record with respect to what respondent said on pages for the whole mortgage allocation theory involving these transactions, there's three pages of testimony, page 519 to 520 and 526. There are those two exhibits, 142 and 144. For the one-time expenses, her testimony is at 507 to 511, 514 to 515. And with respect to St. Clair, 517 to 519 and 521 to 522. And there, the two exhibits go to the one-time claim expenses, and the other two documents are that settlement statement and the affinity loan statement. There is no evidence that the court, when it was amending these, if you could just match up verbatim, but not, it would be better if it was just one person, because then it would show that the court decided, well, who should I choose? What most comports with what I believe the evidence supports? But here, they're both adopted, even though they contradict one another. And so then we had to figure out, well, how, you know, giving discretion to which findings? They're contradictory findings.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. The case is submitted. We appreciate your argument, both the extended argument today and your written submissions to both of you. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Both. All other matters that were to be heard today are no longer on our calendar. So this is our only and final case, and therefore we are in recess.